We look to Capitol Hill now to get the latest on whether lawmakers are any closer to agreement on an economic relief package as millions of Americans fall deeper into financial stress. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The $908 billion bipartisan proposal was viewed as a last-ditch effort. Meanwhile, the Senate needs to act on a one-week stopgap bill, a continuing resolution to fund the government and keep it open. What do you make of the politics? What do you want Congress to do to help the millions of Americans out of work? It's 800-642-1234. Grace Seegers is a political reporter for CBS News. Grace, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, it seemed like only maybe 24 hours ago that the $908 billion COVID relief plan had traction, and now hopes are really fading. What is going on?
Well, I think as with so many things on Capitol Hill, things seem very optimistic. And then as time goes on and more disagreements are revealed, it looks a bit more pessimistic. So Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell told the congressional leaders in the House and the Senate this week that he doesn't think that there is going to be any compromise on state and local aid, which is a Democratic priority, and liability shields, which is a Republican priority. He said he doesn't think that there could be any compromise that would be widely accepted by the Republican caucus. Now, this is according to a senior Democratic aide familiar with the conversations. So you may want to take that with a little bit of grain of salt. But it seems like despite all of these good faith negotiations that the moderates in both parties are accomplishing, it doesn't look like the more ideological ends of both the Democratic and especially the Republican parties are too interested in making a deal.
Yeah, you know, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell has repeatedly emphasized that he thinks more assistance, more aid is needed to help the economy, but it seems like he's framed the bipartisan package as unworkable. What is a no-go here? I mean, you mentioned state and local aid and liability shields. Are these the big sticking points?
Yeah, they really are the biggest sticking points. And McConnell actually earlier this week suggested that maybe Congress should drop these items altogether, and any package that they do get through should not include either of these items. And they can pick both of those issues back up in January when there is a new Congress. But Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, the Democrats in Congress, they were really against this idea, saying that the state and local aid is desperately needed before the end of the year. So McConnell was trying to put his foot in the middle of these bipartisan negotiations. That's what they're arguing. So it really seems as if no matter what sort of effort to compromise either side makes, the other side sees it as bad faith negotiations or as unworkable.
In all of this, what is the prospect of getting another round of stimulus checks for Americans?
Now, that is the question. So in the $908 billion proposal put forward by this bipartisan group, there isn't a round of stimulus checks. Now, Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin made a proposal to Pelosi and Schumer this week that would have included a round of stimulus checks, but that proposal would not include any additional unemployment benefits. So Pelosi and Schumer were against it, saying that it didn't go far enough. Meanwhile, in the Senate, as you mentioned, there is this critical must-pass stopgap short-term funding bill that would extend government funding deadline to next week.
The elephant now, in the room.
The big elephant in the room, exactly. Now, Senator Bernie Sanders, who, as we know, is very progressive, a firebrand in the Senate, he has threatened, actually, to block this from passing unless the Senate votes on another round of direct stimulus checks. He's really trying to force another vote on having these $1,200 checks go out. So we'll see if he actually goes through with that promise, if he actually does try to block the continuing resolution from passing. But that is another element in here.
We're talking, if you're just joining us, with Grace Seegers, a political journalist at CBS News. She's giving us the latest developments on Capitol Hill, the back and forth on the pending pandemic relief, and then what happens on a government spending bill. Taking your thoughts on what you see on Capitol Hill as well at 800-642-1234 and your questions as to where lawmakers go from here. Grace, you know, let's talk a little bit about this spending bill, because if the Senate fails to approve a one-week stopgap spending bill today by midnight, the government will shut down at midnight. Is that right?
That is correct. And it's not only that the Senate has to pass this bill, but also President Trump has to sign it. So that adds to the time crunch as well.
So, and we're not exactly, I mean, the Senate has been confident that they're going to get this through, this continuing resolution, but then it only, you know, kicks the ball forward for 1 week. The new deadline then becomes next Friday. What do you see out of trying to negotiate a spending bill?
You know, in my professional opinion, this is a big mess. There's just a lot of elements going on. And as you said, there's only 1 week to negotiate a new funding bill. So members of Congress have said that they don't just want to kick the can down the road again. They don't just want to do another continuing resolution, extending things as they are through next month or whatever. They want to do a brand new omnibus funding bill. But that requires a lot of negotiations. That requires writing thousands of pages of legislative text. And on top of that, members of Congress have said that they would want to attach any COVID relief negotiations on top of this omnibus bill. So not only do they have to write this omnibus bill and come to an agreement over that, they also have to write and come to an agreement over any coronavirus relief bill and add that. And then, of course, pass it through both houses of Congress and get it signed by the president. And all of that needs to be done if this is assuming that the Senate passes the continuing resolution tonight. All of that has to be done before December 18th. So, as I said before, it's a big mess.
What is the read from lawmakers and, you know, top negotiators on whether you would layer in COVID relief into, you know, an appropriations bill? It seems like you're kind of mixing things there.
Well, that's what lawmakers say that they want. I think kind of because it would make things a bit easier if you just wrapped it into one big ball and then passed it all at once. But you're right, it does make things more complicated in that they have to negotiate the coronavirus relief and the government spending separately and then put them together. And that assumes that there's agreement on both parts of these gigantic issues, which are really critical for American people.
And, you know, give us the size here of a government spending bill. What are we talking about?
Oh, gosh, it would be very big. Mm-hmm. So what we have now, the continuing resolution, is just an extension of our current budget.
Grace Seegers is a political reporter for CBS News. She's giving us an update on where negotiations are on a COVID relief package and a stopgap funding bill passed by the House earlier this week, waiting for Senate action, as she said, on the continuing resolution. How do you want Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to act now on an economic relief package? Have Democrats asked for too much? How would you characterize the response on Capitol Hill to the pandemic? Time for you, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Grace Seegers here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the morning show as we discuss whether lawmakers on Capitol Hill can find a path forward before the end of the year on COVID aid. Also on their plates, draft and pass an omnibus appropriations bill to set fiscal spending for every agency by a week from today if senators pass the continuing resolution. And as Grace said, the president signs to avoid a government shutdown. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Are you worried that spending talks will stall? What questions do you have about the remaining days of the year and what scenarios could play out with congressional negotiations? Do you think there's a will to act or is it political theater? 800-642-1234. Grace Seegers is a political reporter for CBS News and reporting on the situation on Capitol Hill. Grace, I want to look a little bit closer here on extra jobless aid. I mean, if stimulus checks are off the table, what about weekly extra jobless benefits? Where are negotiations there?
Now, that, unfortunately, is another sticking point for members of Congress, because previously established under the CARES Act, we had an additional $600 per week on top of unemployment insurance that was very popular, and that expired at the end of July. And since then, the people who were reliant on these extra benefits have really been struggling. So Democrats, in whatever comes next, they want to include some number of additional benefits on top of weekly unemployment insurance. But Republicans are a bit wary because they're worried about people getting paid more while unemployed than they would while employed. So they're concerned that these additional benefits could provide a disincentive for people to return to work. So that's really another sticking point with both parties in this $908 billion proposal that we discussed that has been proposed by this bipartisan group of lawmakers. They include an additional few hundred dollars a week on top of the unemployment benefits. But again, as also previously discussed, it's not looking so good that that proposal would even be passed. So right now, it's just very murky.
Yeah. And so they were, you know, what was on the table there, as you mentioned, was, you know, $300 a week extra on top of your state unemployment and then carrying that out for, I think it's 16 weeks. Is that what they were looking at?
Yes, that is correct. But again, everything that we know about this proposal from the bipartisan group is not from any legislative text. They haven't written an actual bill, which would probably be hundreds of pages long. What they've done is released a 6-page framework that has a very basic bullet point summary under each of the provisions they're considering. And yes, that does include an additional 16 weeks of this $300 per week.
We're talking with CBS News political reporter Grace Seegers. She's giving us the latest back and forth on Capitol Hill and taking your questions as well at 800-642-1234. Grace, states like Wisconsin have really relied on the National Guard to carry out the nuts and bolts of getting, you know, the testing and certainly drive-through testing and specimen collection. What is the status of on funding the continuation of this National Guard mission?
So here's where we bring in the third element of this mess, which is the National Defense Authorization Act, which is the annual defense spending bill. It's passed every year for the past 59 years. And it has passed in the House overwhelmingly and is currently going to be looked at in the Senate. But there's a bit of a problem in that President Trump has said that he would veto this bill because it includes a provision he doesn't like and doesn't include a provision that he would like. So if this bill does pass in the House and the Senate, but he vetoes it, then Congress may have to reconvene to override the veto. So that is just yet another element in this craziness of congressional negotiations.
What in particular does President Trump have? What criticisms there are, does he have of this spending bill?
So the bill includes a provision that would set up a commission to study renaming military bases that were named after Confederate officials. And the president has previously made clear that he opposes renaming these bases named for Confederate officials. So he is against the inclusion of that provision in the NDAA. And then another thing that he wants included in the NDAA, but which currently isn't included, is a repeal of the social media liability protection known as Section 230. So that is currently not included in the bill because Democrats and actually a lot of Republicans say, no matter how we feel about social media liability protections, that's not relevant to national defense. Mm-hmm. But President Trump wants that included in the bill. And if it isn't included, then again, that's another reason why he's threatened to veto.
Let's bring in a call now. Tom is with us from Burlington. Hi, Tom. What would you like to say?
I study economics at Georgetown University. And when you look at the past history of these depressions, it's going to take massive amounts of money to get us out of this depression. In the Second World War is the thing that brought us out of the depression we had in the 30s. And to see these guys talking about this nitpicking stuff, it's heartbreaking. They have to get the money in the people's hands and get the money rolling around. Everybody's in a desperate situation, and I can't believe why they're just going around in political circles.
Tom, thank you for the call. Grace, Tom is really sick of the bickering that's going on and says it will take a massive amount of cash infusion to keep our economy afloat. What do economists say?
Well, I think what Tom is saying is what millions of Americans are feeling right now, which is that we are in dire straits. And it can appear as if Congress is just bickering over minor things instead of working to actually get things done. So there is no doubt that whatever comes next from Congress will have to be a very large spending bill. Now, Pelosi and congressional Democrats have previously said that they didn't want anything that was under $2 trillion. They're now willing to go below that because Pelosi says situations have changed. Now we have President-elect Biden coming into the White House and a vaccine on the way. So now she's willing to consider something closer to $1 trillion. But the problem is that if Republicans aren't able to agree to this, and if Democrats aren't willing to agree to Republican proposals, then we're not going to see any money come in, much less the several hundred billion or trillions of dollars that would be required.
Let's bring in Joshua now, joining us from Watertown. Joshua, what are your thoughts here?
Well, hi, Kate. So I had a question, to see what your guest thinks about this. What about if they incentivize people to get the vaccine? Instead of giving everybody $1,200, we incentivize each person that if you get the vaccine and stay home for that amount of time to get the second shot, because it's two doses, that the government incentivizes people to do that. I think that would lower the cases, the positive cases, and it would put some responsibility on people to not only get the vaccine, but also to stay home. And then, the relief package would be if you get the vaccine and stay home, then we'll give you the money.
Yeah. So paying Americans to take the vaccine, has this come up at all, Grace, on Capitol Hill?
It has, actually. I have been hearing some rumors about somehow directly incentivizing Americans to take the vaccine, but this is kind of we'll cross that bridge when we get to it situation, because right now Congress is in the midst of trying to pass this stopgap funding bill and then this omnibus bill and then this basic coronavirus relief. And then, on top of that, also making sure that defense spending is reauthorized for the next year. So I do think that we are going to see some discussions about that, but it probably won't be until the new Congress reconvenes in early January.
as you just made the laundry list there of so many issues on the table, what are you watching for in the negotiations over the next few days?
Well, I think what I personally am really interested in is seeing whether the great need that we have discussed of Americans, the struggling that so many Americans are undergoing right now, if all of that does sink in with the politicians in Congress, and if they are willing to get past their differences and go, okay, we really need to pass this. Here's what Democrats want. Here's what Republicans want. So we're just going to swallow our dislike of some of these provisions and make a deal. But knowing Congress, that's not as likely. So it would be nice if the politicians in Congress could see the level of struggling and come to a deal that is amenable to both parties. But given the high level of polarization we have in Congress right now, I don't know how likely that is.
Grace, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Grace Seegers is a political reporter for CBS News. Coming up, we take a look at development in downtown Milwaukee and the impact it may have on adjacent neighborhoods. That's after a news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. We're looking at issues of housing policies, displacement, and gentrification, and what Milwaukee is experiencing, especially as the pandemic-related moratorium on evictions is set to expire within weeks. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. In Chicago this week, rules designed to force developers in hot real estate neighborhoods to build more low and moderate income housing stock will stay in place until the summer. It gives Chicago officials time to revise that city's affordable housing ordinance. So how is Milwaukee doing? How have you seen the city change over the years? What's improved? What challenges have emerged? It's 800-642-1234. Andy Hunt is director for the Center for Real Estate at Marquette University. Andy, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate.
Good morning. We also have Nancy Frank with us, a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee, where she serves as the interim dean of the School of Architecture and Urban Planning. Nancy, welcome to you.
Hi, good morning.
Well, Nancy, let's start with you. You know, gentrification is a term that has quite a bit of baggage, holds a negative connotation. Can you explain what it means or how you describe it to your students?
Well, the sort of nutshell definition is that property values are increasing due to new investment in the neighborhood, changes in property values, and as a result, rents or property taxes are going up, while for many of the original residents, before those new investments happen, their incomes are not going up, and so they start to find themselves priced out of their own neighborhood.
And is that where you see displacement happen?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And sometimes that displacement is more or less voluntary. More voluntary when people say, this is a really good time for me to cash in on my house investment and move to someplace else. And they actually may benefit by moving. But the negative side of that is people who want to stay in that neighborhood. It's convenient for them. They have roots. They're engaged with their neighbors, but they just can't afford to live there anymore.
Yeah, I mean, with displacement, and I know this could vary city to city straight across the country, but in what you see in Milwaukee with displacement, do those residents have a lot of options there before them in order to where they do move to, what new neighborhood they do go to?
I think that depends a lot on where they're experiencing the gentrification or the increasing costs of living where they are and what their other needs are, right? Mm-hmm. So there are certainly a lack of quality affordable housing units in the city of Milwaukee. And for a large proportion of the population in Milwaukee, their income is so low that the standards around affordability almost don't apply to them, because a lot of the affordable units are for people who are at like 60% of the area median. And that doesn't mean the neighborhood median. That means the county or broader area median at income, and their incomes are more like 20 or 30% of that income level. So finding housing that is safe and comfortable is difficult.
Andy, is there a difference between housing gentrification and commercial gentrification? What is that intersection like?
It's a good question, Kate. You know, when I think about gentrification, it seems to be a little bit more holistic than separating it between housing and commercial. The reality is that a lot of neighborhoods are organized in a certain way. And Nancy could speak to this, of course, as well. But you have commercial corridors that then expand out into areas of housing. And so historically, what you want is you want a thriving corridor that can also attract more people to the housing around it. And that housing around it can then also support that corridor. And Milwaukee's no different. We have several corridors where we are spending a lot of time and energy trying to improve throughout the city, not only in more wealthier areas, but also in areas that are in need of a lot more investment.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at that downtown area, the number of planned buildings on the books, the number of projects that are green lit, it's dozens. That has to have an effect on the surrounding residents.
You know, it does. And it starts to get a little bit more into how do you think holistically about a city and how a city is going to grow? And so naturally, if you have a thriving urban center, theoretically, that's going to lead to a more economically successful region. So Milwaukee is a really, really important driver from that standpoint. When you see development and a lot of new development, these new projects that you mentioned, Kate, downtown, the hope is that that's going to make Milwaukee overall stronger, not just that downtown area. Now, that doesn't mean that everybody necessarily benefits from those individual projects. And of course, that's why we're talking a little bit about the potential for displacement, but you absolutely want a strong city as your driver, as your anchor for your region.
Nancy, what is an example when gentrification is a benefit to a neighborhood, a benefit to a community?
I think that it can be a benefit if new development is, first of all, not deals of gentrification are developers purchasing apartment buildings, renovating those apartments, and then selling them as high-end condos, where the renters are actually evicted from their units by the new purchaser of the building, and then all of the new residents are generally much higher-income people that often don't reflect the character of the rest of the neighborhood. So that would be a really obvious example of pushing people out. At the other end would be situations, I think particularly of a neighborhood like Walnut Way, that's done an enormous amount of work to internally reinvest in their neighborhood. And it has had an effect of some rising property values in that area. It's become an area of the city that people really look to in terms of moving to an area that's got a great sort of social fabric and good housing stock. And so is that gentrification when the property values are rising a bit faster than in the rest of the city, but it has come about through investments of the residents themselves? And between those two extremes is every other possible combination of circumstances.
Yeah, I think that's where Andy is kind of seeing that holistic view, is bringing the neighborhood up together. We're breaking down gentrification, what it means for housing, how to sustain community-focused investment and development. We're talking with Nancy Frank, who is an urban planning professor at UW-Milwaukee. Andy Hunt is here, a real estate expert and instructor at Marquette. You can join in on what you see in your neighborhood at 800-642-1234. Andy, how big of a problem is it when developers do come in and revamp a building, making it much more of a luxury, housing unit, maybe going from a multi-housing unit down to a single-family home, or, remodeling apartments and making them high-end? What do you see there?
It's a little bit of a market force type of situation, right? So developers are really driven by the laws of supply and demand. They're not going to make decisions that there isn't some sort of demand for, and so their job is kind of to recognize that and then kind of increase the supply side for where that demand is. But you have to remember there are two other parts kind of to that equation, Kate. You've got the developers, of course, but then you also have the residents within that area or within, some sort of area around that. And then also the municipality, the government officials. And all three really have to work together when it comes to development. And so what's really interesting is that you actually have a lot more developers. Sometimes can get a bad rap, sometimes it's deserved. But there are a lot of really great developers out there, a lot, especially in this city, I can attest to that, want to dive in and understand what the residents want in a certain area. So they figure out that demand. And then they figure out what's the best way to supply that. So I don't get the sense, it's actually harder to go in and to say, well, we need to kick out certain residents to be able to put in some sort of use. Because the reality is in a city like Milwaukee, and certainly in some of these neighborhoods that we're talking about, there's enough, I guess you could say, housing stock or rundown housing stock, or maybe bank-owned or city-owned housing stock, that you could redevelop before you would ever have to go and start to work with properties that have residents living in it.
Nancy, local Milwaukee lawmakers have put together an anti-displacement plan for neighborhoods near downtown. Do those types of plans work?
I think, the bottom line of that plan as I read it is that it will work because it's getting the local policymakers, as well as the philanthropic and the development community, to be thinking ahead about these issues, anticipating, being ready with tools that can not level the playing field. That's not quite the right term, but distribute the pain more equitably among those who can afford it and those who cannot afford it. And so I think that it may be too soon if Milwaukee is going to experience the kind of increases in costs of housing that have been seen on the two coasts. We are the third coast, and Chicago is certainly feeling that. But we haven't really felt that kind of enormous increase. But we could. And we can be ready because we have that plan.
We have urban planning professor Nancy Frank from UW-Milwaukee and Andy Hunt, who heads up the Center for Real Estate at Marquette. We're exploring how Milwaukee neighborhoods are changing, the complexities of gentrification and displacement. Have you been displaced due to rising rent or property taxes? 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for being here. Let's get back to our conversation about housing and development in Milwaukee and what changes residents see in their neighborhoods. According to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Land and Space Development Database, dozens of buildings have been proposed or are in some stage of construction in the downtown area. Nancy Frank is watching this, a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. Andy Hunt leads the Center for Real Estate at Marquette, and they're with us for 10 more minutes. Andy, some cities require new real estate developments to include a certain percent of affordable housing. what impact do those regulations, those quotas, have on the local community and on investors?
I'm a real big proponent of these affordable housing aspects of new development. You know, and it kind of goes back to this theory of what makes a thriving city. So you really do want people of different socioeconomic backgrounds, different races, different sexes, kind of living among one another. In fact, when you talk to a lot of residents about this idea of integration, they love the idea of being surrounded by diverse people that aren't necessarily just like them, especially as you get closer to the urban core. In fact, that's one of the reasons why some people are making that choice to live where they live. And so, you know, affordable housing really is important for a thriving city, because it's not good enough to say, well, we just want to allow the market to go where it wants to go without being able to help everybody to take advantage of that. And affordable housing for developers is one way to kind of get them to incentivize to start to make those kinds of policies. I know a lot of developers who kind of embrace that, because they also agree that having affordable housing as part of their projects is important for the city.
Let's bring in a call now. Monica is with us from West Bend with some observations. Hi, Monica. What do you see?
Hi. I have heard in recent news that Milwaukee is rated the most segregated city in the country, and I can only imagine that gentrification has a hand in that and has contributed to that segregation. And I think you just started to bring up the race and socioeconomic issue, but I was wondering if your guests could comment more on how gentrification has contributed to that segregation in Milwaukee.
Nancy, you first. Racism in housing in Milwaukee, what can you say?
Well, it's not a recent phenomenon, and it's been in the news for decades. And the roots of it go back to really the early part of this century, and in particular to federal policies that were implemented locally related to the eligibility for mortgage insurance, which is what allows most of us to purchase our own homes. It's a big, long story, but what it boils down to is that federal policy essentially mandated redlining. And as a result, urban communities in the existing part of Milwaukee were not eligible for support of home ownership. And any community that had a significant proportion of non-white residents was considered ineligible for that support. And that started this segregation that extended right up into the 1960s. And then the combination of freeways and suburbanization and the suburbanization of jobs kind of solidified that, not to mention, you know, racial discrimination. And we find ourselves where we are today.
Andy, what legacy of redlining do you see when you look at development in the city today?
No, I'm going to agree with Nancy that that some of that federal legislation that took place, especially in the 50s, it essentially laid the foundation for a lot of the segregation that we have in our city today, which is really, really unfortunate. In fact, you know, we've been studying. There was a survey that came out in the year 2000, and it was of a lot of these housing experts and just kind of city experts on a national level, asking them what were the top influences on the American metropolis in the last 50 years. Again, this is the year 2000. And, you know, number two was the Federal Housing Administration's, you know, mortgage and financing regulation, which led to this. And number one was the Interstate Highway Act, which divided up a lot of these neighborhoods and started to tear apart some of this, some of the fabric that we're talking about. So, you know, when you do a good job of development, you knit the fabric of those neighborhoods much more closely, because you're allowing residents to thrive with the kind of services and the kind of investment that they deserve within their neighborhoods. And unfortunately, some of that legislation kind of pulled it away. I think that Monica brings up a great point. We have a very segregated city, and that's a major problem. And I'm not sure if gentrification is really part of that. I think that the segregation was maybe more due to some of those other factors, and we're all trying to battle against that even today, and we probably continued well for a while.
So, Nancy, is gentrification happening in Milwaukee? What is your take?
So, you know, I reviewed the anti-displacement plan this morning to be ready for that question, and having looked at the maps, which are now, you know, a couple years old, I have to say that there are some pockets that one could say are gentrifying, but even there, I'm not entirely sure how much of those increases in property values are really a result of property owner investment as opposed to just the rising value of the land due to the increasing desirability of the area. Certainly, Bayview is an area that people look at as having experienced some gentrification in the midst of it right now. River West, Walker's Point. And Andy's probably better able to answer the question of where exactly he's looking at, where there are signs of gentrification.
Go ahead, Andy.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. We also see, you know, people talk about Brewers Hill. There's an article recently this week that talked about the Hollywood Park neighborhood, of course. You know, Walker's Point is getting a lot of attention for some of this as well. But I think, you know, it's probably really important that we put Milwaukee in a broader context. How does, you know, Nancy, you're right. How does Milwaukee compare to other cities? And, you know, the reality is we do see pockets of gentrification, of some of these values rising, but not anywhere near the level of what other cities on a national basis are experiencing. Certainly places like Brooklyn or San Francisco. Where sometimes this stuff can happen overnight. You know, you speak with professionals and they say, we've been hearing about Brewers Hill gentrifying for over 25 years. And so you start to ask yourself, is 25 years versus more of a, you know, over the course of a year or two, gentrification, is it really the same? It's not. It matters for those who feel displaced. And so that's why these programs are really important to support all these residents here within Milwaukee. But it's also important to look at this from a broader context.
Let's bring in Karen now in Black Creek. Hi, Karen. We're short on time. What is your question?
Hi. I guess I have an unclear understanding of what the difference is between gentrification and redevelopment. If you have empty buildings and you are trying to rehab them, turn them into something else, do you start thinking I'm going to redevelop it, or do you start thinking I'm going to try to gentrify this area? And I guess that's just my question. I'll take my answer off the air.
Andy, go ahead.
Great question, Karen. So redevelopment, I believe, is very different than gentrification. Now, they may be linked, but I don't know anyone who goes into a situation where, again, if it's a demand and supply issue for these developers, because this is a risky investment that if they're purchasing a property and rehabbing it, putting a lot of capital into it, investing in that neighborhood, they're not saying, oh, but, you know, I'm worried about gentrification. They're saying they really are going in with full belief that they are adding investment to that area, that they're taking something that wasn't as good before and redeveloping it into something better. And the neighbors surrounding that, their property values are improved. That's you know, better for their livelihood. I really do think redevelopment is a positive.
Well, Andy and Nancy, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Kate.
Thanks, Kate.
Andy Hunt, an instructor and director for the Center for Real Estate at Marquette University. Nancy Frank, a professor of urban planning at UW-Milwaukee. Just ahead, we explore the memoir Wintering on the Power of Rest and Retreat in Difficult Times. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.